In today's episode, we'll look at more Enigma UAP video submissions. We'll cover the latest news, including a controversial report released by the Pentagon's All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. And we've got a special guest, Dr. Michael Masters. He's a professor of biological anthropology, and he's here to discuss an alternative to the extraterrestrial hypotheses he calls the extratempestrial model. You won't want to miss it. Hello and welcome to Open Minds UAP News. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas. We've got a lot of big news that happened this week with this report coming from Arrow, which is one of the reasons that I've got today's guest. Some of you who have been in this field for a while know about Dr. Michael Masters and his books and his theories, but I wanted to talk about this in particular because, you know, the U in UAP means unidentified. We don't know what it is. We don't have enough information to say. Aliens is one hypothesis. Another hypothesis is potentially people coming from the future. And there's actually been some science around this that's been done. And that's why we're going to have Dr. Michael Masters on to talk about that and how, hey, you know, we don't know what's going on. This model may be just as possible as the alien model. Yet the government is saying we don't have evidence for either. Let's get into the news. So this week, the Pentagon released volume one of their historical record report on unidentified anomalous phenomena. This is a report that was requested by the NDAA. So Congress requested that they put together this report. And the report was very interesting. If you watch the first episode of Open Minds UAP News, then you are caught up because this report really covered a lot of the things that I covered in the first episode. And that, of course, led to the frustration of many researchers because, as we covered, you know, their, I think, credibility is being put into question. And it's kind of embarrassing when you come out and you say, hey, there's evidence that there's aliens and the government's hiding this, and then none of that comes to fruition. And none of it did come to fruition. The verbiage that is used in the report is very important, and I'll go over why. But for that reason, I'm going to read from the report and the press release for the report just to make sure that we cover exactly what they're saying, because the words are very important. So let's get into this. In the press release from Major General Pat Ryder, the press secretary for the Pentagon, he wrote, "The goal of Arrow's effort in producing this volume and the second forthcoming one is to use a rigorous analytical and scientific approach to investigate past U.S. government-sponsored UAP investigation efforts and the claims made by interviewees that the U.S. government and various contractors have recovered and are hiding off-world technology and biological material." That is very important because, you know, a historical review makes it seem like it's going to be very comprehensive over the last 50 years or so, or what the government has done to give us an idea of what they've discovered and why they think this issue is important and that there are, you know, the nature of whatever's anomalous out there. But instead, this report is focusing on the claims that there were off-world technology and biological material that was recovered. And so we'll get into why that's an issue going forward and some of the criticism, good and bad, that's come forward on that. But it's important to note, this is essentially a response to David Grush's claims in his Senate hearing, where he claimed, David Grush being a former intelligence officer, he worked on the UAP task force, the first version, the most recent version before Arrow, of an official UFO kind of investigation group. He came out and said he found evidence, although he said, you know, secondhand, of these crash retrievals, Roswell, this sort of stuff. Congress has been very into it. There have been lots of Congress members who want a full investigation of these claims. And Arrow allegedly has been doing that, trying to look into these claims, although the former head of the group, Sean Kirkpatrick, has said he hasn't had access to at least the primary witness, David Grush. But again, doesn't appear he had any firsthand information. To get back to this press release, General Ryder continues, To date, Arrow has found no verifiable evidence, really important, verifiable evidence for claims that the U.S. government and private companies have access to or have been reverse engineering extraterrestrial technology. Also, Arrow has found no evidence that any U.S. government investigation, academic-sponsored research, or official review panel has confirmed that any sighting of a UAP represented extraterrestrial technology. All investigative efforts at all levels of classification concluded that most sightings were ordinary objects and phenomena and the result of misidentification. Arrow assesses that all of the named and described alleged hidden UAP reverse engineering programs provided by interviewees either do not exist, are misidentified authentic national security programs that are not related to extraterrestrial technology exploitation, or resolved to a disestablished program, meaning a program that no longer exists. So they're saying that they looked at all these programs. They didn't find any of them related to UAP. They go on in the report to say they also did not have any NDAs, so non-disclosure agreements related to UAP that they were found. So no NDAs. No one allegedly has been asked to sign an NDA related to any work on UAP. So that's essentially what they're saying. A couple of things here. Obviously, this is geared towards answering Grush's claims. One. Two, this is a really important point, is that they continue to use the word most. So they're saying in these programs, they're finding that most UAP are something mundane. I think that that is really frustrating a lot of people who are into this topic. Many of them are saying that, you know, the government is saying there's nothing to the UFO phenomena with this report. And that is not what it's saying. It's saying most. I think that that may represent bias to people who are into this topic. However, if you take a step back to people who aren't used to this topic, they're not going to understand. Like, most of us who are researchers or have been in this for a long time know that the vast majority of UFO reports, and we're talking 95%, are mundane. They're misidentifications. We all know that. Even the most ardent alien invasion believer, you know, who's a genuine researcher, would tell you that that is the case. So we've always known that. And so it's important to point that out to the public. It is the case. Most of the time, people make mistakes. That's why at Enigma or with other efforts, we're trying to educate people so that they make less mistakes. Getting into the report, I just want to note a couple of areas that I found interesting. The report is very long, and we'll be talking about this more. In fact, my next few interviews are probably going to be with mainstream news journalists who dip their toes in this topic. And the reason why I want to do that is I want to bring some balance. Those of you who are into the UFO community, there's a strong narrative that is, to be honest, not completely substantiated and a bit hypocritical, and we'll go over that. But people are very upset, and there's a lot of emotion around that. They feel that they had an idea of what was going on, and that wasn't confirmed in this report, and they're frustrated by that. Some of them, of course, believing that the government is not being forthcoming with this information. However, I want people to get an idea of, you know, grounded, kind of skeptical journalists who were open to this topic, what their experience was like, and the good and the bad looking into this topic and where they stand today and their interpretations of this report. I think that's going to be really important to get us to a grounded area to move forward, because their views are important. This is a view of the mainstream, and these are the ideas we have to consider if we want to move things forward. Getting into the report itself and some of the notes that I wanted to make, first on incursions at nuclear facilities. Of course, that's an important topic. The Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies just recently, if you go to explorescu.org, put up a couple papers where they took data, mostly from Blue Book and other places, of the good cases and analyzed those to find out if there were more sightings statistically around nuclear facilities, and they did find some interesting information there. Here's what Arrow said. Arrow interviewed approximately 30 people who claimed to have insight into alleged USG involvement in off-world technology exploitation or to process knowledge of UAP that have allegedly disrupted US nuclear facilities in the past. So they did talk to some people related to some of these things. Some of those witnesses, they even talk about like events at Malmstrom. So we know a gentleman by the name of Robert Salas, who says, you know, he was working in one of these bunkers of an ICBM back in the 60s when a UFO was seen by the gates on the ground level. He was underground. And then soon the missiles went offline for a short period of time. They associated that with the UAP. But essentially, Arrow saying here, we need more data, that we take this sort of incursion very seriously, but we need more data on these cases. So they didn't really come down on an opinion on that, which is interesting. But overall, the general consensus here is that we just have a lot of anecdotal information, and anecdotal information isn't enough, and we need real data, just like I told you last week. That's what they're saying, and it's fair. And I want to read this section about it because I think they make some important observations. Arrow and DOD assume that individuals convey their accurate recollections of their perception of the events they observed or heard. It's important to note that Arrow cannot discount nor rely on interviewee accounts alone because of the extraordinary claims contained in their reports. Although individual accounts are important, they are only one element of the larger picture and provide Arrow with the opportunity to initiate an investigation. However, any final assessment on the veracity of these accounts must be accompanied by provable facts. And that's where we are. That's where I am. We've got an abundance of very credible, interesting, anecdotal information. That gets us to look. It doesn't give us answers. We need these provable facts. We need more data to gain answers. These are another great points regarding anecdotal information. Some literature suggests individual accounts can be unreliable as they are subject to a person's interpretation of sensory data through the filter of their experiences, beliefs, or state of mind during the event. A person who reports a case might be credible in that they believe the elements of their account to be accurate. However, their reliability, which is their ability to accurately interpret events, as well as to recall and convey those events due to a range of factors, is altogether different from their inherent sincerity. That's a really important point. My degree is in industrial and organizational psychology, and we look at this quite a bit. In fact, I wrote a few papers on because of UAP. I was looking into the reliability and the best way to get information from witnesses. And witnesses are highly, highly unreliable. The best thing you could do is get the information immediately, right when it happens, before someone talks to anybody. That's going to be the most accurate, because as soon as they talk to anyone, as soon as they hear people making comments about the situation they just witnessed, immediately studies show your memory changes. You begin to adapt to the things that you're hearing, and all of a sudden you're saying things you wouldn't have said just a few minutes ago about what you just experienced. You believe it's real. You genuinely are trying to be accurate, but because of just the way our brains work, that information just isn't there anymore, or it's been manipulated. This is, of course, another really important thing they make. Similarly, confirmation bias is a recognized subconscious cognitive process whereby a person tends to seek and believe information that supports their hypothesis and to discount information that undermines their hypothesis. And of course, this is important for all sides because the skeptics do this too. You know, they'll have a bias that this cannot be anything unusual. So they'll explain away things that aren't easily explained away. But of course, it happens to the other side a lot, where without evidence, they're demanding. And that's what's going on now. This is the case. I have no evidence to prove anything I'm saying, but gosh darn it, I'm mad, and I want you to admit that what I believe without any evidence is the truth, or at least without substantial or verifiable evidence. And that's the hard part. So all of us, you know, people who write and research, you build in, you know, ways to hopefully mitigate these sort of issues. So for example, in science, as a scientist, your big job is to disprove your hypothesis, to make sure that, you know, you're doing your best to make sure whatever your hypothesis is has some veracity, is accurate. And in journalism, there's the same thing. And which gets people frustrating is that you got to give the other side just as much time as you do the primary person you're talking to. This gets frustrating because you may be interviewing someone who is very credible and their opponents are not credible. But you want to give them the same time because you want to be fair and you don't want to appear to have any bias, or you want to be sure that your inherent bias that you're aware of isn't influencing your reporting or accuracy. So that becomes difficult. So they're right. Anecdotal information is flawed. It's very flawed. It's not enough. Another note that they had in their Project Kona, Politico wrote an article about that. I'll have links to these articles, of course, in the description. But Project Kona was essentially the OSAP years. This is the kind of secretive group that was doing some research on UAP and other paranormal aspects. They proposed to have a project where they analyzed materials that were obtained from extraterrestrial craft, but that project was never approved because that group could never prove that there was any material that they had obtained from anything off-world or anything anomalous. In fact, there was one metal that was mentioned that was analyzed by Arrow that has been something that has been the proponents of ET kind of technology have been saying that this is something anomalous. Arrow said it's not. Other scientists out there have also said it's not. I've kind of lately been on the side that the abundance of science coming in lately is showing that it was not something anomalous, and Arrow says it's not. I believe this part, the way it was described, is what's called art parts. So Art Bell was received this material decades ago anonymously, and it's been investigated ever since then. So that's the piece that they're discussing there. And then a final note here, when people ask about where's the information about, you know, who they talked to and some more details, they say volume 2 will be coming out, and volume 2 will include any finding results from interviews. So a little bit more information about interviews and stuff that they use to make the determination in this volume. It'll also cover their research from November of 2023 until April of 2024. That probably means we'll see this report sometime next month. A couple more thoughts before we wrap up this part is that they're right. There isn't verifiable evidence. We have anecdotal information. We have no verifiable evidence of, and especially of any crashes. Roswell is really arguably the best alleged UFO crash case out there, and it's not a very good one. There is just anecdotal information. And I think one of the damning pieces of information on the Roswell case is that the three eyewitnesses, four eyewitnesses who were on the grounds and actually saw the material, three of them say it was obviously balloon material, and only one said it wasn't. And that one person described material that fits the MOGA balloon material to a T. In fact, this witness also had said material in a photograph that was a weather balloon is the material he collected. So very, very dubious. And that's the best crash case out there. There's just not evidence. I'd love to see evidence. I've been looking for it for many, many years. I have not found it. The other thing is most UAP sightings. And I think that this is where there's been some wordplay. A lot of the UFO community, including an article I'm about to go over from News Nation, they say that, you know, that this report is saying that all UFO occurrences are explainable. That's not what this report is saying at all. It's saying most are. Most is very different than all. And they're still alluding to doing more work. And we'll talk about that, looking for UAP. Finally, Garrett Graff, who I hope to have on the show soon, he wrote a book about UFO history recently. I thought it was mostly very good. I mean, I think there are some inaccuracies. In fact, there's a part in this report that was not including in his book that I don't think Graff was aware of. So, but otherwise, he did a great book. He wrote an article recently, and his question was, they told us a lot about what they didn't find, but they didn't tell us what is being hidden, because certainly something's being hidden. People have criticized his book, saying that it was kind of a cover-up itself, that it just kind of glossed over and a whitewash, but not really. He's saying there definitely is something being hidden. And I think this is the answer. I think he makes a great question. And I think that that question hasn't been asked. Is you talk about secrecy and why secrecy is so important. You talk about how you want to be transparent, but it's difficult to be transparent regarding UAP. Why? Why is it so difficult to be transparent when you're talking about UAP? That answer, though, I think is very sensitive itself, and that's why they don't speak to it. The closest they got to it was in May 2022. There may be another instance where they spoke to this, and I would love it if you out there find it. But in May 22, during the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence Subcommittee on Counterterrorism, Counterintelligence, and Counterproliferation hearing on UAP, and this is one of those cleared committees. So in other words, there are committees that are around armed services and intelligence where there are members who are cleared for classified information. That's why these interviews kind of seem different, and why Congress people have a different take. And we're going to definitely talk about this in a little more in just a second. Scott Bray, the deputy director of Naval Intelligence, said in that hearing that security classification guide that UAP Task Force has been operating under that I approved really was meant to protect those sources and methods, and meant to protect any knowledge that any adversary intelligence entity may gain from understanding what we are tracking, how we are tracking it, or when we are tracking it, or if we are not tracking it. And so that's been an important piece in the balance between transparency and preserving our warfighting advances, because the U.S. military does train as it would fight. So what he's saying here is we don't want the enemy to know what we're doing, how we're doing it, when we're doing it, if we're doing it. That so essentially anything we do around some of these sensor capture activities is going to be classified. He said, what I will commit to is at least for that material that is under my authority as the Deputy Director of Naval Intelligence, for information that we have when it does not involve sources or methods, or and when we can, with reasonable degree of confidence, determine that it does not pose a foreign intelligence or national security threat, and it is within my authority to do so, I commit to declassify it. So I believe very much in the transparency of this, and we work very hard to balance that with our national security needs. So it's kind of like I've been saying here. It's a very high bar. So in other words, we will declassify it if we confirm it doesn't have anything to do with foreign intelligence, it doesn't have anything to do with national security, and it doesn't reveal sources and methods. We'd be more than happy to share that. The tough part is with this topic, all of those are going to be in play. If you have an object you cannot identify that seems to be advanced technology, how do you verify that it's not foreign technology? Technically, it's not ours. It is foreign technology. You must assume it's worldly foreign technology till you have evidence of otherwise. They have no evidence of otherwise. they're saying that none of us is beyond the abilities of known physics. And if that's the case, then it's not beyond the technological potential capabilities of a human enemy actor or entity. And so it's going to be really hard for them to reveal information. And I think that that was the closest. And when I heard that, I was like, exactly. He's essentially telling you that it's very difficult to declassify anything when it comes to this topic. One other article that came out of all of this is Tim Phillips, the acting director for Arrow. He, in a press conference, or at least in an interview with Defense Scoop, and I've got to say that Defense Scoop, especially the coverage by Brandy Vincent, their reporter there, hopefully I can get her on the show eventually. She's doing a great job reporting there. But she asked him about the report. He wouldn't say much, but he talked about a new program that they're doing where they're creating these things called Gremlin systems to capture more information about UAP. He told them, we're working with some of the government labs, such as the Department of Energy labs, and we have a great partnership with Georgia Tech. And what we're doing is developing a deployable, configurable sensor suite that we can put in Pelican cases. We're going to be able to pull it out to the field and do long-term collection. Since the UAP target, that signature is not clearly defined, we really have to do hyperspectral surveillance to try to capture these incidents. This is currently being done on a large range in Texas, he says. As far as other advanced technology, he said, there's been some cases, but we can't discuss that here. So in other words, a couple things. One, they're building these systems to look at UAP. This stuff about this report saying UAP is no longer important, that doesn't seem to jive. That's not what they're saying. They're saying this report was a response to the Grush claims, obviously. And obviously they're still into looking at UAP and now using these Gremlin systems, which almost sound a little bit like some of the systems like UFO DAP. If you haven't seen it, just UFO DAP, you could go check out the website where they're building these sensor suites where they can collect information on any UAP that fly by. It's a great project. It's the type of project that needs to be advanced so we can grab more information. So it's exciting that they're doing this. But just like we said, just like we had discussed about Bray, Phillips, the current Arrow acting director, says, as far as other advanced technologies, there's been some cases, but we can't discuss it. So they have seen cases of what appear to be advanced technology. They can't discuss it. Why can't they discuss it? Bray told us they have to clear it. They have to be sure it's not foreign technology or some national security threat. How are you going to clear it from those things before you declassify it? That's a lot to ask for. Perhaps they'll never be declassified. But in the end, although we don't have an explicit statement like this in this report, we have had explicit statement like this in other reports. And I don't think this changes that everybody still believes UAP are a real concern, a potential safety issue, and something that needs to be researched. That's important. That's good. We need to continue with that. They also say there's no evidence of aliens. True, we don't have that verifiable data. If you believe aliens is the answer, well then, you know, let's get some data and let's prove that, and data is obtainable. And then finally, we need more data, obviously. So this is interesting. In response, there have been some Congress people that are asking now for a special UAP committee. I did say Congress seems to be overall happy with Arrow on the last show, that it seems overarching sentiment, at least with some of those people that are in those committees that are cleared for some of this classified information, they seem to be all right. But there is a group that is not happy, and they call themselves the UAP Caucus. They started in August. They're called bipartisan, but I don't know if you could really... That's a bit of a stretch to call him bipartisan. Here's why. The UAP caucus is made up of Tim Burchett, Republican from Tennessee. He's also saying that they're hiding information on Bigfoot and all kinds of other wild stuff. Jared Moskowitz, he's the only Democrat from Florida. Anna Paulina Luna, Republican from Florida. She's the one who recently said that she absolutely believes aliens are visiting. Nassie Mace, a Republican from South Carolina. Eric Burleson, a Republican from Missouri. And Andy Oglis, a Republican from Tennessee. So it's largely Republican. And it's definitely a lot of verbiage around, you know, some of them have said, I believe Burchett and Luna have said that these guys who have access to classified information that are Congress members are also part of the conspiracy and are also lying to us. But they are asking that there be a committee put together to look into this. The report from News Nation said that the Arrow report reiterated that the government is not aware of any extraterrestrial craft and that reported sightings have been the result of misidentification. That's not what they said. They said most. They did not say all. So they're not closing Arrow or closing their interest in this topic. Burleson said he was concerned that the Pentagon is not being completely forthright in its denial about the UAP programs. He said defense officials were not truthful to members of Congress in private when sharing classified information. That's interesting coming from Burleson because he's also said he doesn't believe they're aliens, that he believes they're foreign technology. But now he's saying that he thinks that the Pentagon's lying. So he's kind of got some mixed messages going on here. Burleson said that he had not questioned Speaker Mike Johnson on this issue, but he does already have the support of a few other leadership in the House in order to create this UAP committee. Whether or not it'll happen, we'll see. I'm all for more transparency. So if this committee happens and they bring more witnesses who can bring evidence rather than just anecdotal rumors or hearsay, that would be great because we would all love to get to the truth. So we'll see what happens with that. Finally, in our last bit of news, Avi Loeb and the Galileo team from Harvard are under fire at a lunar and planetary science conference in Woodlands, Texas. Essentially, what happened is one of the representatives came to talk about these sphericals that they retrieved from the ocean that they are purporting to potentially be extraterrestrial technology. The crowd at this science conference got upset because they're aware of the situation. As this article said, they're trying to not even entertain these hypotheses or these ideas because they're so way off base. But at this conference, they got pulled in and they began debating. So essentially, what has happened is Avi Loeb from Harvard, he really got into this topic with this interstellar object that came into our solar system called Oumuamua, and then it passed through, but there were some anomalies, at least in the way that its speed and the nature in which it left. There are a lot of theories about why it did what it did, but Avi Loeb proposed the idea that it could be extraterrestrial in nature. He then received information that there was a meteorite, potentially another extrasolar, meaning something that came from outside of our solar system, that had come and crashed in the ocean near Papua New Guinea in 2014. He went to the area, tried to get some samples, analyzed those samples, and said they were anomalous. Other scientists are upset because they're saying, one, the material you found is not extraterrestrial. It's known. It is actually parts of a meteorite that crashed and dispersed these things all over a lot of the ocean and can be found in a lot of places. So it's not unusual. It's not extraterrestrial. And even worse, more recently, a group wrote a paper saying there wasn't even a meteorite that crashed near Papua New Guinea in 2014. It was a mistake that the tremors that they were listening to were caused by a nearby truck, not by a meteorite. Avi Loeb is saying, well, the DOD told me it was a meteorite and you don't have their information, so I don't believe you. I believe them, even though the DOD is certainly not the experts in this. And that's what's most important. You know, you got to talk to the experts. So we'll see. I think we're going to see a lot more controversy around this. So there's the news coming up next. So let's get to our interview with Dr. Michael Masters. All right. I am very happy to welcome our first guest, Dr. Michael Masters. He is a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Technological University in Butte, Montana. Welcome.
Thanks, Alejandro. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you as well. One of the reasons you're here is that you've written this book, Identified Flying Objects. And essentially what I would like to discuss is that you're kind of proposing, and you've done some research to show that it's plausible, that there's an alternative to the what is called extraterrestrial hypothesis, which is that perhaps what we're seeing really is advanced technologies from a third party, but it might not be aliens. In this case, maybe it's us from the future.
Yeah, no, exactly. it's an idea that occurred to me when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I've been pursuing the question ever since, and especially in the context of long-term evolutionary trends and hominin morphology and technology, because our technology has evolved in lockstep with bigger brains and just an expanding frontal and parietal cortex in general. Obviously, being cautious of selection bias and confirmation bias, just keeping an open mind to this question of whether it could be us. And obviously, I don't think it explains all of the phenomenon. It's much too complex and mysterious to be just this one thing. But based on the description of these craft and the description of the beings so commonly seen in association with them, I think it is important to consider this possibility. It's certainly not one that I claim ownership of. The idea has been around since the late 1940s with Commander George Hoover, Herman Oberth, one of the fathers of rocketry here in the U.S. post-World War II. So, yeah, I mean, the idea has been around for a while. I'm just kind of bringing together some different fields, and especially in that first book you mentioned, IFO, bringing together a multidisciplinary approach, focusing on anthropology, obviously, astrobiology, astronomy, and physics to make a case that we should at least consider this as a possibility.
Great. And let's look in those areas. So when it came to anthropology, what were the indicators or some of the work that you researched that you found that kind of support your ideas in that area?
Well, that's a great question, Alejandro, because that was actually the first thing that got me interested in this is when I was 8 or 9, I happened to look up at our living room shelf and see a picture of Whitley Strieber's book. It was the only book that was facing out toward the living room. And I had this sort of white flash, sort of this moment of awareness where I thought, what if they could be us? And as a young child with no education in evolutionary anatomy or synapomorphies, it was really just a question that entered my mind, potentially an aspect of precognition, which I've had my entire life. And anybody interested in that can seek out Eric Wargo and his two great books on the subject. What struck me is just how similar they were. Bilateral symmetry, eyes, nose, mouth in the same place. Craniofacial features that seemed to be the same as ours, just more evolved. And one thing I tried to avoid in writing this book and each of my books really was to avoid speculation about what might happen between now and then to make us look like these beings, because it really doesn't matter. What is more informative, I think, and what I really tried to stick to is things we can know. What trends have dominated hominin evolution throughout the last 6 to 8 million years since we first stood upright, started walking bipedally, which is the trait that defines the hominin lineage and is ubiquitously described in cases where these beings are encountered. But what are these trends? And the biggest trends, the most dominant ones, are an increase in cranial capacity. We have brains that are about 3 times larger than our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, whose brains are about the size as these early hominin ancestors going back to about 7 million years ago, about 420 cubic centimeters. So there's been an expansion of our brains forward and mediolaterally, especially in the parietal lobes up here. In association with that, our mid and lower facial anatomy has been reduced and retracted. So it not only got smaller, our teeth, our masticatory musculature got smaller, but everything moved back. And there's this trade-off. It's a common, what we call bow plan. You can see it really well in domesticated dogs. You think of a Doberman Pinscher, low sloping forehead, long snout, we call that prognathism, versus a pug or a chihuahua where they have this retracted face and a rounder forehead. And that goes for most mammals and certainly us. In fact, we're the only mammal where this has happened to the extent that our eyes sit directly below the brain and in very close proximity to one another. So there's a lot of things just in the craniofacial anatomy that jumped out at me early on, indicating that, you know, there's something to look at here. They could potentially be us. And then you factor in post cranial anatomy, you factor in the technological changes and an evolution, not just linearly, but an accelerating geometric curve of evolutionary change. And there's a lot of things that seem to indicate that rather than being from a different planet, who evolved the same way as us on a different planet with a different gravity, and most exoplanets, the vast majority that we found so far, upwards of 95%, are much larger than Earth. Only about 2 to 4% are the same size or smaller. So we're also, in addition to being the only mammal with our eyes that are under our brain, we're also the only habitually bipedal mammal. And it causes a lot of problems. We suffer from a lot of problems with that. So it's unlikely that we would get the same evolutionary process to have upright walking humans, essentially, with bilateral symmetry, two gut openings, can breathe the same air, can have sex with each other, can speak the same languages. They can speak our languages in countless cases. And that we evolved at the same time and close enough to each other that they could come here and find us, and that they would be only slightly more advanced than us. So I argue that the more parsimonious solution to this question, or at least a part of it, because I don't think it explains all of it, but a part of it is that they are simply us coming back through time to visit and study their own past.
Right. And to your point then, really, and just so people in the audience know, you know, Whitley Strieber wrote a book that was kind of the first one to really make this image of an alien that we see, where it's kind of this tear-shaped head, large head with a large eyeballs, not much of a nose, slit for a mouth. And this is all anecdotal information that we're getting from people who claim to have experiences. But this image that of the gray that has now become so iconic, the point you're making, which makes a lot of sense, is that especially using Occam's razor, what they're describing sounds more like an advanced human rather than something extraterrestrial from another planet. And it would make much more sense, even scientifically, that it would be an advanced human rather than something from somewhere else.
Yeah, and you know, we also have to be cautious of the psychocultural, psychosocial effect, where if there is this iconic image, is it perpetuated as a result of this, or are people just describing seeing the same thing? And I trend toward the latter, because there have been people coming into contact with people that not just have those gray alien characteristics. This was sort of a failing of my first book, because I mostly focused on these long-term evolutionary changes. But then in my second book, The Extratempestrial Model, I realized in studying the UFO phenomenon in much more detail, and in many cases across the world and through time, that one covers 5 continents over about 90 years, that the majority are actually human, just like us, doing things that we would do. One of the first cases, Mike and Leo Dworshak in South Dakota, come across these people. They're humans. They can speak the same languages. They're doing jumping jacks and collecting insects, grasshoppers specifically, and knew the future. They told them that they're there to study the ecology, the environment, as our planet gets deeper in trouble. So it's almost like they knew what was coming, because our planet is in trouble now. There's no denying that. And it's likely to be in even greater trouble as we have more people and this geometric curve of population growth and resource usage. There's a lot of things that I think should be taken into account. It's not just the morphology, but it's the behaviors. And we can pick patterns out. It's not just speculation, but it's an abductive approach that looks at all of these encounters, evidence. I would argue that this is evidence. At least it would hold up in a court of law. But we do have issues with defining evidence, and then we need to get out in front of that as this conversation moves forward, especially in the scientific community. But if we can consider these instances of close contact, and it's important to recognize patterns that unfold amongst those. And with an abductive approach, you're looking for inference to the best explanation. So it's that Occam's razor approach, like you mentioned, and the simplest answer with the fewest assumptions would seem to be that they're us, or at least some component of them are us, because we know we're here. We know we've had a long evolutionary history on this planet, technologically, morphologically, physiologically, and we're likely to be even more advanced in the future.
Right. And it's interesting to note, too, someone who claimed to have touched an object, and this was a military guy in the UK in the 1980s, associated with the Rendlesham Forest incident. I know you're very familiar, and you've referenced
Jim Peniston.
Yep, Jim Peniston. And that's interesting that he, of course, also feels, you and I know this, that what he experienced in this object he touched was advanced technology from our future.
Yeah, that was communicated to him in so many words that with binary code, I guess, so not really words at all. But yeah, it was interesting because I was just about to publish that first book, Identified Flying Objects, in 2019, and I happened to someone mentioned the case of Jim Peniston, and I looked it up and was like just blown away because not only is he arguing that at least those individuals were future humans, but they said specifically where through this binary code that he downloaded as he had missing time as he was in contact with this craft, that they were from the future, 8,000 years in the future, and whether that's from 8,000 AD Common Era or 8,000 years from when he touched it in 1980, it's hard to tell. But they also gave GPS coordinates of, I think, 7 or 8 really instrumental human landmarks to indicate that they do know our past and were potentially visiting those sites as well as part of their own deeper past. So, yeah, and then another interesting correlate too that I talk about a lot in both my first books is what is with the focus on gametes with genetic material. And during a hypnotic regression session, and obviously people should, exercise caution of taking these too seriously because there are logistical issues and methodological issues, but they do also allow us to enter parts of our minds that aren't right at the forefront of our consciousness in these physical bodies. But what came out of that session was that they were coming back through time to solve problems they were having with reproduction. And they were coming back into the human past to sample chromosomes, as they said, but DNA, genetic material, to help with these problems. And I had already written about that too, as part of my first book, just again focusing on long-term trends associated with genetic homogenization, gene flow among all of these various groups that used to be separate populations. Now we're one amalgamated island on Earth, just floating through space, interbreeding with each other. And eventually, that continues, incest would be an issue. So to get new wild type genes, the only place to get those, if you can't just go to the next planet and sample other humans, and some would argue that if there is a seeding program or something like that, we could. But again, that adds another layer of assumption. So to keep it simple, if we do have the ability to go back into the past, we could sample gametes from haplogroups that didn't make it into the future, thus diversifying our gene pool. So then I also in my second book looked at other trends that are happening now, such as a 60% reduction in sperm counts in the Western world and a 50% reduction worldwide, issues related to in vitro fertilization and bringing genes into populations that, as natural selection would see it, aren't supposed to be there. Other things related to exogenesis chambers and growing human fetuses outside of the body, which seems to be the way that we're moving and helps with a lot of social issues and economic problems as well. So just kind of exploring these things, looking at what people describe seeing, what happens, what they see on these craft, and talking with these people, as I would argue, at least most of them, and what can we get out of that? What can we learn from that? It's observational research. It's what we do in anthropology. You can't experiment on humans. You can't do experiments to give people trauma to see if they start to have ESP abilities, psi abilities, if they have precognition, remote viewing abilities, telepathy. But you can see the people that do, that are in contact, that have been in contact, oftentimes from early age, and see what the differences among them, what patterns emerge from that, what their experiences indicate, and do observational studies to try to get at the bottom of this UFO question.
I'm really glad you brought that in, and you added to that because you make a great point that even the narratives from these stories include, the third party claiming that they're from the future, and I think that's a great point too. Moving forward, the physics. What did you find when you looked into the physics of it?
You travel through deep space, and what I've often argued is that it may take backward time travel technology just to achieve interstellar travel, even within our own galaxy. Obviously, it may be prohibitive to go to other galaxies, but within our own galaxy, if you were to travel, say, 10 light years away, ship time, at close to the speed of light, something like 50,000 years would pass on Earth. And nobody wants to come home to a planet that may not even contain your species anymore after that period of time. So I think the two likely will develop together and likely do exist together. And if we are reverse engineering these things, we're not just reverse engineering spacecraft, but also time machines. So just from the basic aspect of time dilation associated with special relativity, we may have to figure out how to go back in time just to get home. Yeah, there's so many things. There's disruptions in time space. They seemingly have the ability to pause time in and around these craft. A lot of people talk about everything going silent. There'll be birds chirping and animals. And then when they get within what Jim Peniston called a sphere of influence, it's dead quiet. And that would seem that they have the ability to stop time. There's an interesting case called, I think, Abducted from the French Quarter, a book that describes being abducted from one of the busiest areas of New Orleans, people taken from skyscrapers in New York City, Los Angeles. So, one of the first cases I mentioned from my second book, Mike and Leo Dorshak, they specifically told him that. He asked, "You have these lights, these bright lights out here in this field. Aren't you afraid of being seen?" They told him specifically, "We stop time within a 3-mile radius. So there is no movement. There is no time. So people can't see us," essentially. Linda Jones, another case, she's running along with her daughter trying to escape this UFO, and the grass is growing at tremendous speed under their feet. The trees closest to where Travis Walton was abducted grew at a faster rate based on a tree ring analysis that was done. The case of Corporal Armando Valdez from 1977 in a rural part of Chile, he disappeared for what was only 15 minutes to his men. I believe I actually saw you talk about this a while back in one of your Open Minds episodes. That might have been where I learned about this case, actually. But according to the beard growth on his face and the watch that he was wearing on his wrist, 5 days had passed from him. So clearly there's this way in which these craft, which I argue at least the disc-shaped one, are time machines themselves. They have the ability to manipulate the flow in our perception of time in order to mask themselves, most likely to achieve these incredible G-forces that we see. What looks to us like a 10,000 G maneuver, maybe closer to zero or one for them. They can also hide from us in plain sight. If everything on Earth is slowed down and they're just zipping around the skies, again, it might seem to them as a very normal acceleration, deceleration maneuver. But if you slow down a lot of images, our friend Shane Hurd showed me one of these that was captured where if you slow down the frame rate of this, and the human mind can only perceive about 30 to 35 frames per second, but if you slow it down, you can see this very clear elongated objects just zip across the screen. They may be doing that all around us all the time, but it's because they distort time that we don't perceive them. So once you factor in that temporal component, I think there's a lot of aspects of the phenomenon that start to make more sense.
Now, coming from academia, how do you feel, what have the changes been like? You know, you're mentioning how we might be finding answers and hopefully getting more people involved. And do you find your colleagues kind of opening up to this topic or to actually getting involved with research?
Yeah, I do. I'm contacted constantly by people with bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, who are interested in finding a way to research and write about and talk about this phenomenon, because two things, they feel driven to do it. A lot of people just feel this compelling force. And I felt that too, since I was roughly 9 years old, sort of driving them in this direction. And there's a lot of issues still with that, especially for early stage scientists. I waited till I had tenure and full tenure and full professor status before I really launched into this, just because that's what those protections are for. That's why they're put in place in academic institutions. But even outside of that, you have places like IONS and studies like the Dr. Edgar Mitchell Foundation Free Study that's doing a massive survey of contactee experiences and other institutions as well, the Monroe Institute, for instance, what's happening at Stanford with the Soul Foundation. So there are institutions or subsets of universities that are starting to say, screw the stigma, let's just do this. And that's been my approach since I did get those protections was, I'm going to stick my neck out I don't care what happens. It's a conversation that needs to be had. We need to be talking about UFOs. And I've gotten some backlash, but it's also been a great deal of support. I was asked to teach an honors class entirely about my first book and this hypothesis. I was given a research and scholarship award right before I went on sabbatical last year from the dean of our university. Was congratulated by the chancellor of our university when an article about a featured article in Fox News and space.com came out about this theory in my first book in 2019. So institutionally, I feel very lucky. Montana Tech, you know, our slogans are big ideas, big mountains, open skies, open minds. Like we're one of the top science and engineering universities in the Pacific Northwest, but really it goes beyond that. You know, it's pushing the envelope. It's a lot of research that does even, you know, contract with the Department of Defense in various ways, nanotechnology research and all of these things. So my experience, you know, I don't know how it translates to other departments, other universities with colleagues in other disciplines. Oddly, psychology seems to have more hangups than most. Physicists seem to be a little more open-minded. Cosmologists are just shutting down everything left and right. Adam Frank, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Brian Greene just have these knee-jerk reactions to anything that doesn't fit neatly into their preconceived notion of physical reality, which I think all of us are going to need to challenge to move past where we are and to begin to understand not just UFOs, but the things that happen in association with them, like telepathy, like missing time, remote viewing, all of these psi capabilities that seemingly are linked with consciousness and the UFO question in ways we don't yet understand. And I think that's the next step is as this stigma wanes, we need to start sort of inching toward these other questions that have also been off the table, such as consciousness, for this entire time. So yeah, I think we're moving in a good direction. It's really great to see. And I would say optimistic about the future of this subject and others like it in academic institutions.
That's really great to hear. It's very inspiring. And then the last question I have for you is, in my experience, you know, they're approaching or working with scientific communities or groups on this topic. They seem to be like really not into the extraterrestrial idea, but they love the multiple dimension type of idea that maybe something's coming from another dimension. And it's, I think, just because there's more science and math around it. But it seems like they would also like your hypothesis better as an alternative. I would imagine, and I would love to hear that you get a lot of positive reactions, or at least kind of, hey, that's an interesting idea, but I like it.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons they like multidimensional so much is because it doesn't say anything. It doesn't answer the question of who they are, where they're coming from, what they are. It passes the buck. So interdimensional just become this catch-all term without actually designating the origin point of these beings and the craft. So I actually consider this extra tempestrial model, this extra temporal hypothesis, as an aspect of interdimensional, because if they're moving across the fourth dimension or using some dimension beyond the four that we understand now to travel, then it is interdimensional. It's part of the same thing. It just goes a little farther and says, they're us. That's why they look like us. That's why we can reproduce with them. That's why we can mate with them. That's why we can communicate and all of these other things. It's why we look like them. It's why we have bipedalism. Which is the trait that defines our phylogenetic lineage. So yeah, interdimensional is easy because you don't have to actually answer the question. And then there's all these other issues. Are you talking about the brain, the woven, the expanding, the quantum models of a multiverse, interdimensional travel? But yeah, I think this one is maybe too specific for some people. And I do get pigeonholed, and my research gets pigeonholed. Even though from the beginning I've said I don't think this is the only explanation, people just assume that there's this false dichotomy, the straw man thing happening between the extraterrestrial and the extratempestrial. And that's not the case either. It can be both. And in a recent talk I gave in Mesa, Arizona, I showed how it can be both very, very clearly. So yeah, I think the question of origins is the next thing up. We first had to demonstrate that UFOs are real, and I feel like we've gotten to that point, at least the vast majority of us have, other than the aforementioned cosmonauts. But I do think that we need to approach it carefully with an open mind, but as Carl Sagan said, not so open that our brains fall out. We need to look fastidiously at the different theories that are on the table. And this has been happening. I saw a slide from Carl Nell's presentation at the Soul Foundation that laid all of these different theories out in a very succinct and comprehensive way. But I think that's where we're going. And you're starting to see people talk about that more in science as well. But also the mainstream, we're starting to have that question asked more, but we do need to be cautious in approaching it and keep everything on the table until there's a reason to toss it out.
If you want more Michael, definitely go to Amazon or visit the links in the description to find his books, Identified Flying Objects, a Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomenon, and his latest one on this topic, The Extratempestrial Model. And then you also have, I believe this is a fiction book, right? Revelation, yeah. The Human Past.
Yeah, it just came out in June. So it's pretty recent. And it explores all these same ideas, but in the context of a satirical hard science fiction time travel novel. So people have been enjoying it, but it is fundamentally different from the other two. It brings in science, but it's sex, drugs, and UFOs. So it's kind of a different genre altogether. But the strict multidisciplinary hard science approach you'll find in the first two.
Great. And I've spent enough time with you to know that you have a great sense of humor.
Yeah, some people have called the book hilarious. I guess it's a funny storyline with funny dialogue. So if you enjoy some crass humor, I guess definitely check that out. But yeah, congrats on the new show, Alejandro. And yeah, thanks for having me on as your first guest. It was great chatting with you.
All right. Thank you very much to Dr. Masters. I think it's very important to look at other ideas and theories out there and to demonstrate that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is just one of many potential things that the unidentified in UAP could be. We just don't know. And that's the point. They are unidentified. Speaking of unidentified, let's look at the Enigma Labs videos of the week. We have partnered with Enigma Labs to bring you interesting UAP sightings weekly that they collect via their app and their website. If you have a report to submit, you can download the app at the Apple Store or submit it via the website at enigmalabs.io. In the interest of full disclosure, I am a paid consultant for Enigma, and that's how I can keep up to date on the best videos that are coming in. And I'm really excited to share with you some of the cool stuff that we're getting here on the show. So we're going to be looking at two videos most weeks. Last week, it was just one, but going forward, we're going to look at one that has been posted by Enigma that is, I believe, explainable, so we can have a teaching moment so I can show you what to look out for. And the second one will be one that is more anomalous or mysterious. I'm not saying it's definitely something unexplainable, but just a little more weird and fun to look at. And I love your input to see what you think about it. So let's take a look. So this first one that we're going to look at is from Clinton Township, Michigan. It was recorded on October 21st, so just recently. And I'm going to big screen this because it's a little hard to see. But at the top here, you'll see this light. It looks like a star because it doesn't seem to move. And then below it, there's another little light. But here's the telltale sign. There's also on the very bottom a super bright light, probably from a house. Looks like it's a house light or maybe a street light. I think it's from a house, but it's so bright you can't even see what's around it. And every time you're out at night filming and you have a bright light like this, you're going to have an internal flare. And when you're holding your phone, your every slight movement of your hand is going to make that little image or that little reflection also move. And then it looks like it's moving erratically. So if I push play here, you could see it looks like, oh, what the heck, this little round thing zipping around. But you'll even see as she zooms out, it moves further down. It's essentially just corresponding to the movements of her hand. And that's what that little light is. Go try it. If you take your phone and go film a street lamp tonight, you'll have the same effect. You can kind of play around with it. and get used to that. So don't be fooled. Another indicator of this issue is they'll say, I can see it in my phone, but I can't see it with my eye. That's because it's not really there. It's just a reflection inside your phone. This mostly occurred at the beginning of this video, so I'll play it again just so you can see that. So not a UAP. That is a reflection. So just want to share that with you to keep an eye out for that sort of thing. But let's look at the more mysterious video. And actually, it's just on the other tab here. So this one is from Greater Manchester, England, from the UK. So maybe I'll turn on the sound so we can hear their cool accent and what they have to say. But this one's kind of weird. I think it's probably a couple of floating Mylar balloons. But what's strange about it is they do seem to keep an equal distance from each other. And a balloons, Mylar balloons are usually, you know, round or solid. Like the flickering is not steady as it is up there rolling or tumbling or, you know, being manipulated by the wind. You see a lot of flickering as there's reflections off of it. The reflections on these are weird, almost like it has one flat side that is reflecting. And that's why I just wanted to share this with you, because it's pretty strange. Look at that. It's almost like they're kind of these discs that are kind of going like this and then catching the sun and reflecting once in a while, just like my hand is with the light. That's what I'm guessing. But they do keep that equidistance from each other, and it's just not similar to something I've seen before. Again, likely balloons, but I would love to hear what you all have to say out there, especially if someone can identify what it is. Maybe some kind of balloon that's dark on one side, bright on the other, or something more mysterious. What do you think? It's a very short video. And this is the other problem. Even when we get back to that Arrow report, this is very little data. All we've got is this video, maybe a couple of witnesses. Maybe the guy filming this is the mayor, so he's a very credible witness, or the local priest or something. But there's just too little data to really determine whether this is truly anomalous or not. Likely balloons, but we'll never know. So in a lot of these cases, just like I was interviewed by our local station here for Phoenix about the Phoenix Lights, because the anniversary was just yesterday. We don't have enough data to decide what occurred in Phoenix in March in 1997, just like we just don't have enough data in those Navy FLIR videos, even with the witness testimony, to determine what those were and be certain that there's something that couldn't be created here on this planet. It's just not enough data. That's why we need better sensors, and we need to grab more data to figure it out. Thank you so much for joining me this week for Open Mind UAP News. I hope you enjoyed our guests and got something out of this. We'll have more great guests coming up. In fact, like I said, we're going to focus on, I think, some mainstream journalists who have dipped their toes in the UAP pond and see what how they felt about that experience and get some details from them and their ideas on this Arrow report. So we've got some really exciting shows coming up. Please stay tuned. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you have feedback, email address is in the description. Would love to hear from you. Or, of course, you can make comments below. I'll check them out and try to answer your questions as they come in. Thank you so much for joining, and we'll see you next time. Mm-hmm.